Hello, everyone. Good to see you. I want to thank President Chop for her kind invitation to speak to the class of 2013, to their families and friends, to the faculty, staff, students, and other visitors. Welcome to this beautiful place, a place for contemplation and reflection. Something that I've been doing a lot of as I prepare to leave Swarthmore after 25 years. Now I have to say, this is not my usual place for doing business. I feel more comfortable speaking with you one-on-one and in a smaller place, preferably my rock and roll office. But here we are. Many times I've been asked, how did I become a dean and how I learned what I needed to know to function as an advisor for all of these years? The simple answer is that some key Swarthmore people believed in me and my previous experiences, none of which were directly related to higher education. Rather, they noted my role as a community activist, as a junior high school art teacher, my parenting philosophy, and that I, too, am a graduate of a small liberal arts college, meaning that I, too, can switch from political science and art to a career in deaning, because I too have broad-based skills and flexibility from my education. I learned how to be a dean by being guided by some of the most wonderful mentors, educating myself about issues in higher education, and listening to stories. I long ago learned that if you know a person's story, you can better understand that individual and why they do what they do, what makes them tick. These stories came together to create a bank of experience and understanding that enabled me to gain insight into and support members of this community. So now I'll share some of my personal stories to show how I learned my values, how to dean, and hopefully share some ways in which you too might learn from life. About privilege. Growing up, we didn't use that word, but through various experiences, I realized that I was a person who was having an easier life than others. I was born into an academic family. My father was a math professor, and my mother had a master's degree, something rather unusual for a woman who was born in 1910. This was a time when faculty made pitiful salaries, but I somehow absorbed that I was a member of a privileged class, because I had educational and cultural capital. It wasn't about money. I was rich with education and experience. I lived for 10 years in a segregated South in Atlanta, where I learned about another of my privileges, my color. Experiencing separate waiting rooms, restrooms, drinking fountains, clearly spelt out to me that there were things that I could do that others could not do, places that I could go that others could not go. We moved to Bethesda, Maryland, and I learned about another type of my privilege, my citizenship. My mother was forced to relinquish her Canadian citizenship so that my father could get security clearances for his work. My mom always thought of herself as Canadian and wondered why she couldn't be trusted. My last example concerning privilege was when I didn't have it. And some of you have heard this story before. I was a female in a time when there were few opportunities for women in athletics. My male high school schoolmates got the teams, the coaches, and the opportunity to learn. In California, my college roommate had to join, pay for, and drive an hour to the LA Tennis Club for her training. I recall watching an early round professional match played on a public park court. I watched her play the soon to become famous Billie Jean Moffitt King. And I thank you, Billie Jean, for what you have done in bringing this privilege of athletic participation to women. On being a feminist. Perhaps you can understand why I'm a dogged feminist based on those pre-Title IX experiences. Other life experiences taught me about the need to support women and their aspirations. I had college friends who had to go to Mexico to get an abortion or had to leave college if they got pregnant or married. After I graduated from college, I did get married, and we moved to Cambridge, Massachusetts, where we entered the world of the coeducation of the Ivies. We were at Harvard and then at Princeton when they were becoming co-ed. At Princeton, I wondered, where are the women going to eat and congregate? Because all the eating clubs were all male. It was a time of change and struggle. While I know that the reintroduction of female fraternities here has caused a lot of discourse and disagreement, I do believe that women should have control of some social spaces and some social personal life on our campus. Next came our two daughters. They are strong feminists, both having worked to make the world a better place and a safer place for women. I am proud to say that my husband, Larry, a longtime professor here at Swarthmore, as well as a professor at Northwestern and Princeton, always strongly supported women in his economics classes. We keep in touch with many of these fantastic women and applaud their careers and their life choices. And one of them is just about to join the economics department as a new faculty member. But my grandkids are boys. How do we educate them and support them to be good citizens who understand their privilege while still allowing for their success and their achievements? How do we make sure that they understand the needs of others and the importance of equity? I'll be joining in that effort soon when we move to Montana and I get to share in their lives as their grandmother and become their dean. Speaking of guiding these young boys, let's talk about misbehavior and one's moral compass. Growing up, I was expected to be a mannerly person and be well behaved. Don't embarrass the family. I got a few spankings with the wooden spoon, but I was aware that the guidelines and assumptions of our family were my real moral compass. I don't believe in physical punishment, but I do expect people to do the right thing, to accept responsibility if they do something wrong, and then try to educate themselves if they have made poor choices. I still recall our daughters saying, "Mom, would you just punish us?" But in my mind, that was the cheap way out. A way where you didn't have to look your misdeeds in the face and learn to make better decisions. Through my study of history and political science, my experiences parenting, and my experience running the judiciary process here, I know that laws and rules and punishments don't always work. They are necessary. They are a necessary underpinning, but they don't always fix the problem, and there can be unintended consequences. It can be too easy to turn to the law, but I feel if you have to use the law, broadly speaking, you have lost. I think we need more humane and personal techniques to reduce the conflicts and heal ourselves and heal and respect others. Resiliency. This is my current interest. Life is not always fair. Bad things happen to good people. Things don't always turn out as we would wish. But it is how we cope with these difficulties that define us. On a personal level, I live with a husband who has been felled with mental illness and is operating at about 10% of his usual gusto and high achievement. I begin to feel my age. I'm about to leave a career I love and people who have meant so much to me for so many years. At work, this has been the most difficult semester of my 50 semesters here. I find I'm tired and dispirited. I'm disappointed to experience a campus climate with factions and individuals in deep conflict about the nature of this place and how we treat one another. Many have come from places of deep hurt, and unfortunately, others have been hurt here. Yet I am still hopeful that Swarthmore will find its way back to its Quaker essence and positive community. I've often told students and their parents that taking some time off, going on foreign study, or exploring the real world will help give perspective and develop some sense of direction and inner peace. I intend to follow my own advice to get off the grid, slow down, look at the world through the eyes of my grandkids as a way of rebuilding my resiliency. And I hope that as you engage the world in a different way and in a different space, you will think about how to maintain or restore your resiliency. My education around diversity. I've been fortunate to live and travel to a diverse set of places: Lafayette, Indiana, Atlanta, Georgia, Bethesda, Maryland, Evanston, Illinois, Santa Monica, California, Cambridge, Massachusetts, Princeton, New Jersey, Seoul, South Korea, Alexandria, Virginia, and Swarthmore. My husband was in demand as a strategist for developing economies and their industrial sector, so we had the opportunity to travel and live internationally. In the late 60s and early 70s, we lived in South Korea three separate times, and our older daughter was born there. During our 25 years at Swarthmore, we have had sabbaticals in Thailand and in the Netherlands. With broad exposure to East Asia, South Korea, Thailand, Cambodia, Hong Kong, Taiwan, Japan, China, I found much to appreciate in the aesthetic, but found attitudes toward women and the lack of democracy unsettling. Curfews, armed police on corners, poverty. But I learned about how different cultures work and what they value. And I have witnessed the extraordinary economic development of these Asian nations and how they have bettered the lives of their citizens. There are good and interesting people everywhere. Long-term friendships develop. I found that by getting involved, that facilitated getting acquainted. You perhaps can hear some continuation of things I've already talked about. The understanding of privilege and diversity, a love of art and travel, family, people, and their stories. Learning at Swarthmore. At Swarthmore, I've played many roles and was mentored by the best. It was on-the-job training coupled with my values and principles. Happily co-joined with the values and principles here. With our foundation values of academic rigor, knowing there is a light in each person, caring about the individual and the community, expecting the best from each person, and the partnership we have between faculty, students, and staff, Swarthmore College has been an overwhelmingly positive experience. I found congruence in Quaker plainness, the Swarthmore quirkiness, and our way of looking out for others and connection to social justice. This has been a wonderful home, a place to continue learning from life and to interact based on those lessons. Learning from life never ends. I have a deep faith in education in the broadest sense, and I hope you share that belief. Each of you has a unique story, just as I do. So I end by asking, what story does your life tell? What will people learn from you and you from them? I encourage you to keep open your eyes, ears, and hearts to the new experiences you will be encountering, to be open to new opportunities, to become involved, to attend to your moral compass, and above all, to listen to the stories of others. They will teach you much that will help you to become a person who lives the considered life. Congratulations to you, class of 2013, to your families and friends, and a hearty thank you to all the members of the Swarthmore community who have been part of this chapter of your life. Good afternoon.